You're going to be fortunate to have a real sharing of brains. You're going to peer deeply into the two individuals' brains who are on the podium. And so this is a real mind meld. Tomorrow, in the morning, if you're interested in the dark secrets of your own brain, show up for breakfast at the Coke Pavilion and the one of the rooms there, and you'll be able to see some surprising and interesting facts about how your own brain works. There'll be a workshop where you'll be participating. And you'll learn, as my brother Eric tells me, some dark secrets about yourself. And then at 11 o'clock, we finish with a session on what makes you unique, studies of the brain and personality, and how some of the things we've been talking about, some of those of you who followed the sessions earlier today, about how we know your own brain functions to create a personality, a character and a personality. But today we are extremely fortunate to have Bob Woodruff here. I met him on a plane, on a shuttle. Sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not. I was very fortunate on that particular shuttle flight, and it was delayed, as it usually is, and we had a nice long time to chat. I was in the process of planning this with my brother Eric, and he kindly offered to participate, and not only participate, but share in a very deep way some of the experiences. You can't get deeper, I think, than the sharing that he will have with you today. And I think all of us are very fortunate, first of all, that he's survived. He's in wonderful shape. He is willing to speak about it to you, and he's doing an enormous amount to help our soldiers who have been injured and others with brain damage survive and thrive as he has done. I recommend to you his book, which he'll be happy to sign. He's going up afterwards to the Pepke Book Pavilion, so you can get copies for signature of In an Instant that he has written with his wife. So it's a great pleasure to introduce this panel, Eric Hazeltine and Bob Woodruff.
I just wanted to give you some context for the discussion this afternoon. This session is on consciousness. And we neuroscientists studied this probably more interesting question in neuroscience. How does the brain create consciousness? In lots of different ways. We look at the physiology of the brain, as some of you saw this morning. We look at behavior. We look at introspection. But perhaps the most powerful tool so far in understanding how the brain creates consciousness is in understanding people who have had brain damage. Because it's taking away a slice here, a piece there, that tells us if you do something here, this aspect of consciousness has changed, and if you do it there, a different aspect of consciousness has changed. And over many different patients, we've been able to start reconstructing just how it is the brain does what it does. And so that is why we were incredibly thrilled and really honored by the courage of this individual who's going to share some experiences. And I think the overarching point we want to make here is that a lot of times when you go to lectures on science, you hear about things someone else has done in a laboratory. What we're going to do here today is the laboratory is here. It's going to be Bob, it's going to be me, and fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be you. Because we're going to help you catch your brain doing what it does in ways that might shock you. So hang on to your seats, and I'm going to turn it over to Bob.
Well, I have to say, first of all, just thank you just for even having me at all, because I think this was, 9, 10 months ago. There's not a chance in hell that I could have sat up here and actually speak the English language to you, because this has changed significantly. Just to go back, because you've probably seen some of this on various places on TV for the last year. But back in the very end of 2005, the choice at ABC was to make me and Elizabeth Vargas the co-anchors of the news. And that lasted, as you know, about effectively 27 full days before something happened. And one of the parts of this job is I never really wanted to be an anchor at all when I got into this business. But this was the chance, or at least there were two of us, so that there were times where I was not going to be trapped inside the studio. And I could still go out to stories. And one of the first ones that we did while I had this job as an anchor, was to go over to Iraq and to go with the 4th Infantry Division and to see exactly how they were doing and trying to pass over some of the power of the military army over to, or for the U.S. to pass over to the military to see how they were doing. The State of the Union was happening there, so Elizabeth went over to the State of the Union to report from there, and I was over there to say exactly what's happening. This was the first time in about a year and a half that I'd been over to Iraq. I'd been in Iraq a total seven times, the first two times with when Saddam was in power, and then five more times after that. This was the fifth time that I was back since the war began, including the invasion in 2003, which I was with the Marine. But this was now going back to the Army, because all the other times between that, I had been back and really dealt with the basic regular Iraqis, because really from that time, from the beginning of 2003 to the middle of 2004, we were able to actually wander around the country of Iraq. We could go and check into hotels, go to hospitals, talk to people on the street. For me, traveling all the way from Baghdad down to Basra in the south was also possible to do. But things had significantly been changing. So we went up to a place called Taji, which is about 12 miles north of Baghdad, when we got into a tank. To say exactly, you know, what is happening. And it's when we were actually traveling along in that tank that actually right about where you're sitting right there is when there's an IED exploded. Now, I still to this day don't remember or feeling any of everything that happened there. But it exploded where you are. And I was here in the tank, and my cameraman, Doug Vogt, was right in front of me and just to the right. And that went right through all these rocks and metal came through here and destroyed a lot part of my left part of my body. It actually shattered the shoulder back here, cut open that skin. A lot of these rocks went into my jaw and my neck, and it was really almost hard for me to remember, because what happened was because air comes out in advance of this IED, which is 155 millimeter, when the rocks finally followed behind the burst of the air, I was already out and unconscious for about a minute. And then I'd fallen down into the tank. And it was at that moment that, I don't know how they did it, but I looked up and I saw Doug Vogt, my cameraman, and I saw Vinny Malhotra, my producer, and I saw some blood coming down Doug's face, and I said, "Are we still alive?" And they looked, "Yes, we're still alive." And I think I said a couple things, like, "Let's go kick their ass," or something about these guys that attacked us, but I don't really much really remember very about it. But for the next 15 minutes or so, there was a gunfire that broke out. They closed down, they opened the back of this tank they were in, got us in a vehicle, got us about a mile down the road. And at that spot is where a helicopter came in with two pilots in it to pick us up and take us off to Baghdad and then up to Balad. All within about 37 minutes, they got me to the place in Balad where they then removed this part of my skull, about 12 centimeters of my skull, or maybe 14 centimeters, I can't remember, that allows my brain to then expand. So I think what happened, because it was relatively quick, I think my ability of my brain to recover, I think, is a lot better than had I been in the United States at that moment and there was an IED that hit me. The kind of decision to quickly cut off the skull the way that they did was really a huge savior for my head. It could have taken maybe multiple hours, maybe even a day, maybe even not even done if it happened in the United States. But this is one aspect of what's happening in the war right now, is the doctors have been absolutely remarkable. When I did wake up, about 36 days after I returned to Bethesda Naval Medical Center, which I made there in about 72 hours, and I'm still in a coma, and I go on a C-17 back to Bethesda, and for the next 36 days, I was in a coma. My family had no idea what would happen to me. They had no idea if I would wake up. They had no idea if I would not be able to think, whether I'd be able to see, whether or not I would be able to think or speak. It was almost impossible to really tell. Anything could have happened. So imagine during all that time, my wife, my brothers, my wife's sisters, parents, my parents, my friends, neighborhoods, neighbor friends, all came to the hospital to stand with me. And there's moments every day when my wife would come into the house and she would just, they would rub my feet, hoping that I would eventually wake up. And there was that one moment where I finally did wake up after 36 days. I was waiting for her to come into the hospital room. And I looked up and she walked into the house, into the hospital. And I looked up after waiting her for 3 hours because it was 4 o'clock in the morning when I woke up. And I looked up at her and I said, "Hey, honey, where you been?" But anyway, at that moment, I couldn't rename names of just about anything. I have four kids. I've got Mac and Catherine and Nora and Claire, and I know their names perfectly now. But at that time, not only did I not really remember the names of my twin girls who are seven, at that time were just barely almost six. I couldn't remember not only their names, but really quite recognize who they were. I couldn't remember the names of half my brothers. I'd call them all David, which is my oldest brother. But Mike and Jim didn't have a name anymore. I couldn't remember any of the states, names of the states in this country. I couldn't remember the names of any countries in this world. All of these things I did not know anything about when I woke up. But it's now been, I think it's been over a year now. It was actually last March 6th of 2006 that I woke up. So it's getting close on a total of 1.5 years, really, since I woke up. So there's been, like I said, a huge change. But I just want to show you some video that I've got, generally, of what I went through. First, you're going to see how I was able to speak when I was on television, when I was an anchor, even before I was an anchor, and just how normal, without forgetting words, and what it changed to, and what I went through. So if you can go ahead and rape these, ride these, what do you call it?
Run the video.
Yep. Yes, run. We'll take a look at the very beginning. Just to, at least just to see...
This is downtown Gaza. You can see fully immersed in electoral politics.
We're just outside the shrine of Imam Ali in Najaf, one of the holiest sites in Shiite Islam.
Good evening from Jerusalem, where there is an enormous cloud of uncertainty hanging over this holy city and this region tonight.
So the next thing you're going to see is just what the rocks look like, for example, when they hit my head. You know, it came all on the left side of my brain. And you can see basically all the rocks on the left side over there. Those are the ones that stuck into the side. My helmet actually protected to some degree my head, but you can see the cutout of the skull at the top. That's the 14 centimeters of that. And these rocks came in. One of them did, again, through my scapula down here. And this was the side of my head. These are the scans of what was happening back then. And that's essentially what it was. And that's that the rocks that actually went, you know, were still outside the area where this was removed. This rock down there that you see went all the way through my neck, and somehow, some kind of miracle, you could figure that went all the way through my neck, all the way to the other side, and stopped 1 millimeter short of the artery on the other side. If that had gone through there, it absolutely would have changed.
6 years ago, since...
And here's how I speak immediately.
6 years ago,
days
we woke up after 33 years.
No, days.
Days.
Days ago. You woke up.
Really unsill. No, I'm feeling that I look really unsill today.
Really on what?
Today, I'm like, hey, how you guys doing?
Well, you're tired.
Yeah, well, that's
so that's, you know, the doctors say that's the way it's going to go. Some days you're going to be real energetic, and then you can get tired.
That's my brother Mike talking.
Bottle.
So here's where I had to learn all of the new words. This one called? These are words everybody knows.
Oh, yeah.
What they are.
Hammer.
Yep.
Hammer. H-A-M-O-R. Hammer. H-A-M-M-E-R. Hammer.
I'm going to have to go away from the double background. I'm just going to have to go one thing.
Can you give me back the one
that
has scissors on it?
That was the first time I saw my kids.
Has it risen?
Has scissors.
All right, well, this is a phone for making a cut.
Are those scissors?
Come on, Grandma.
That's you.
Belt buckle.
What?
Belt buckle.
Belt buckle.
Belt buckle.
Belt buckle.
Belt.
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 No, Nora, you're confusing him. Belt.
Belt.
Buckle.
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 Belt.
Buckle.
Buckle. Belt buckle. You taught me! Belt buckle!
Diamond!
You did
diamond,
it!
Diamond! Diamond!
I can't really talk, but I can certainly dance that dance.
Well, that Walt Disney hat was not because I worked for Walt Disney, but I don't know how it happened, but it did. But then I had to learn how to do words. And what you're going to see here is some of the first things that I did. I actually told my brother I got this amazing sentence, and I want to write this whole thing. It's the truth. And I sat down on the floor, and I wrote this. And I still, to this day, don't know exactly what it is. Something about love and tempest. These are the first time that I written one night, and this was going to be the long story. This was going to be about 3 hours that I wrote there, and that's what I came up with. This is some of the names of the doctors. Now, my writing is actually quite clear, and this is what it looked like in those first few days after I woke up. That's me trying to write down the names of my doctors. And this is the test, my first rehabilitation test, where they connect the alphabet and the numbers together. It took me 7.5 minutes to put this together. About 5 days later, I was down to 3 minutes and 12 seconds to complete that. I think now it's about 30 seconds that I can do that. But that's basically what happened to me in that time leading up to the end of me recovering. I've seen a lot of MRIs that have been taken in my brain. We've done some CT scans. I went by and I talked to some that had seen with fMRIs. But it seems to me there's really not that much known generally about what's happened to my brain. I mean, I'd love to put this thing together sometime when we get a chance to do more of a scan of exactly what's happening in my brain and what happened to it and how it was different. But it's been explained to me by a lot of people that what's happened to you in terms of your inability to remember words, which I still do to this day, I can't think of so many names. Someone said to me that what it really looks like is that if you own an office, a company, and you're in an office and you've got a big file and a cabinet, and what happens during this explosion is that out of your files, the papers all flew out of the window and went down and landed on the street outside. So now the job for you is to get out of the office and get down there and gather up these papers again and go and put them back into the file. But what I tell them is that there's something different about this, about what happens to you when you lose your ability with these words, is that some of those papers, for some strange reason, are actually flying off of the road up into the window and back into the file. You don't have to bring them all, but some of them somehow are connecting back together. I still don't know to this very day why, after having not known all the words of the states, that I couldn't name a single one, suddenly they would just start coming back. I was not restudying the names of all of these states, but they just popped back into my head. So those are the ones that flying automatically off of the floor, back up into the window, automatically into that. Which ones you have to restudy, rememorize to try to get some of these words is significantly different. Because, you know, because I was hit in this side of my head, what doctors have explained to me is that I lost my language. This is the language size for me. If I'd been hit on this side, there would have been more in terms of my physical problems. Then I'd be limping. Maybe my arms, my legs not be working properly. Or also my vision. My vision, I wouldn't be able to reach out to you and like figure out how far away you are. That's what's happened to a lot of others. You got hit largely on the right side. Where exactly hit in my head is that this is the part right here that's still missing that's now been replaced by a piece of plastic. So the language is a big problem. Now, how it is that some of these words I remember, like I remember that I couldn't remember the head of England. I couldn't remember Tony Blair. So even to this day, I still Hillary Clinton. Sometimes I couldn't remember her name. Maybe it was Hillary. It was very confusing to me. But some reason I could always remember Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran. Now, why that one, I still really, to this day, I have no idea. There's a story, too, that my wife tells a lot of people, which is during those weeks and months after I woke up, that I would try to remember and communicate things to her. And there was one, for example, I know that there was a problem with the phone at our house, and I couldn't figure out how to call the company that was dealing with our phone, that owns the phone. And it's actually the Verizon that I needed to call. And I said to her, I need to get to that Viagra. And then there was also this time where I went to my back to Michigan to visit some friends of mine from high school, and I got to get better with one of my good friends, and she had gotten larger boobs medically. She had them enlarged, and to my wife, I came back to Lee and I said, yeah, but this friend of mine, I think she's got exploding breasts. So now this morning, we heard from, was it Jeff Rosen, right? See, there's another name I sometimes forget. Jeff Rosen is a great lawyer, and he's talking about how they're going to use not only just determining whether somebody has committed a crime or should be imprisoned, that maybe should be based on their action, not on their thoughts inside their brain. Are they going to be actually... should be going to prison because of what they think. Maybe you can measure inside the brain through what we're talking about. Should they go to prison? Well, at this point, maybe, if they just raise this thing about Viagras and exploding breasts, maybe I'll be arrested for perversion. But anyway, so I've been getting through this very slowly, and I've had so many times where I've met with people who have seen me speaking, and you can see the difference between the way I used to speak. I mean, that was kind of relatively natural, but there's sometimes where I talk to you about there's some words that don't pop up. And people sometimes say to me, you seem okay, you seem normal to me. And it's very frustrating to me because there are certain ways that I faked through things and changed it. But what I explain to them is there are moments when people come back from the war and they have been injured. And let's just say that they've lost two fingers, for example. And people look at you and you say, I've been hurt. I'm in a terrible position. I've been injured. And that people will look at the soldiers and they'll say, but you just lost two fingers. What's wrong with that? And what if you had explained to them, but I was a pianist. Then is that different than what you were before? Now, my job as an anchor certainly was to use language. You know, I had to be relatively smooth. I had to be able to come up with things fast and go live. So my ability to get this through this has changed significant. What I think is that the one ways that I'm able to fake some things, like even this, I mean, you can still see me scutter a little bit. But with a lot of words, I think what you all have is synonyms of a lot of different words. Let's make a simplistic example, which is if you look out and you see the street, you also have other words for it, like road, highway. I know you probably have some others. Now, in the very beginning, after I woke up after this coma, I could not even remember a single name for street, let alone road or anything else. But as I went further, I was able to remember a lot of words, but not many words. So I don't have the synonyms anymore of other types of words, complicated words that you have, and certainly when you guys speak. But I'm able to speak and find words now that I do without worrying about the other synonyms. But with words, though, with names, that's why it's still a huge problem for me, is because all of you only have one name. So if I don't know a name, then I can't really talk about that person. Now, if I've been to cover, for example, the campaign, I'm going to have to know all of those people running for the president. And if those names keep slipping out, maybe like Hillary Clinton's name, that slips out again, I've got to somehow go live about reporting on somebody like that. And I can talk about presidents. I can talk about, what am I going to say? Well, that's that president guy, Bill, the one who's a president too, and his wife, and she's running now. I can't do a report like that. It's got to be a lot clearer than that. So I just think that's something I'm just going to have to get through slowly. Now, one of the things that I'm also doing is, since I was hit on this side like I explained before, I've been told many times that it's because this is language on this side, that there's probably some kind of damage to the part of my brain where I know the English language, and that's the one that's been damaged. Now, what they say is that up to age 6, if you can teach your children a new language up until age 6, they will be able to develop that in the same part of the brain what they would have learned on their natural language of English if they live here in this country. But if then after 6, like when I studied Chinese and I studied French and I studied German much later, that's in a different part of my brain. So there's always a translation that goes between the one where your English language is, or maybe if you learned another one, to those. So maybe that's a different part of the brain. So one of the things I'd like to do is I want to restudy Chinese, for example, to see if I've lost so much of it, because I lived there 18 years ago. It was the last time I lived in Beijing and really used the language, but I used it a few times here and there, but I lost a lot because of this explosion. If I try to study it again, will my improvement of Chinese, for example, see, I can say the right word, Chinese, will that actually work along better than my improvement of my English? Because it's a different part of the brain. Because we still don't have the ability, really, right now to scan the exact spot, I think, as much as I know about this, to actually fix or figure out exactly which part of the brain we can actually improve this. So I want to study that, because there are different parts of the brain that I still don't understand. I have talked to doctors that have dealt with fMRIs, and they said that just learning generally about what that does for the brain, they're probably still 20 years away before they really understand exactly what's happening in it. One of the things I also want to talk to you, because I want to ask some questions from you as well, but you know, one of the things we've been working on, my wife and I especially, and my brothers too, is to try to get some more rehabilitation, cognitive rehabilitation, for so many of the others that have gone through this kind of traumatic brain injury that I've gotten. It's a very strange position that I'm in now, because having gone through that, I have to explain this a lot more. I mean, I can't really hide. I have to go public about this. I have to talk everything that I've gone through. But one of the main reasons I want to do with that is because I think we just need to learn a lot more about traumatic brain injury and what we can do to possibly fix things. And one of the aspects that I learned from the very beginning when we came back, that even though in the beginning of the situation when I was getting help from the military in terms of the doctors we talked about, the life, the things that we saved, the quickness that they got me back and my skull off was really wonderful. But eventually for a lot of these guys, these soldiers and Marines that come back and have also TBI, and especially those that are not necessarily recognized as having had a traumatic brain injury because they haven't lost a part of their skull, is they need to have the ability to go anywhere near their house where they finally go back to their home to find a hospital. If it's a VA and it really knows what it's doing, okay. But if the VA does not know about a traumatic brain injury and what to do, that shouldn't be the one that the soldiers and the Marines should be forced to go to. They should be going to the other hospitals they might near there where they've got doctors and OT and PT and everything else that works with this better than anybody else, because it doesn't seem to make sense to me. You know, we have in this country about 1.5 million a year that get some kind of traumatic brain injury. And this is not from the war. This is not from an IED. This is from getting a car crash. This is getting a baseball bat hit in your head, or some kind of criminal actually tackles you and throws you on the ground, or whatever what happens to you. And about 1.5 million a year go to hell for TBI. That means they're going to local hospitals. So why not get a private insurance for those that come back from the war to get the best one near their house where they're near their children and their family, to get that help? Not necessarily traveling around the country to the one or two or three or four places in the VA that can actually do this. This seems to be one very logical to me. Yeah, because we have so many now that are coming from this with this kind of injury that I've got, and we know so little about the brain. We need to help so many more in this war than any other war before. Because, for example, in Vietnam, you had about 57,000 soldiers and Marines that were killed in that war. Now you're up to about 3,500 in this one, which is significantly fewer. But back in Vietnam, it was 2.7 to 1 in terms of those who survived, injured, versus those who died. Now it's at least 16 to 1 in terms of injured versus those who passed away. So now you've got this issue of what is coming back now to our country. I think some thought for a long time it was just those that had their arms cut off and their legs cut off, and those are the ones that were injured, and that was the vision, I think, seen to so many people in the country before this news about traumatic brain injury and PTSD arose, is they assume that is probably what people are getting. But the fact is there's so many that are getting TBI. We believe that between 10 and 30% of those who have been in the war between Iraq and Vietnam and Afghanistan is about 1.5 million, therefore about 150,000, at least 10% of those who have some kind of traumatic brain injury. And even though the government has really only recognized or said that they only know of about 1,875, when our number really more looks like 150,000. So to me, living about brain, being at a place like this, to learn from the smartest people that I think I've ever met in my life, to try to figure out what to do about the brain. There's a lot of questions to be asked. What can we do? Can we figure out inside the brain whether you're guilty of a crime? That's another question. But in terms about what you do to try to fix a brain or to figure out exactly what you've got when you're asleep and your eyes don't open, and then after about 3 weeks, the eye opens and you still can't necessarily see if the person's thinking. We've got a way to figure out exactly inside that brain, are they thinking? And when I wake up and I'm able to speak, can my wife get some kind of scan that will show, you know what, in 15 months he will be fine? Or you know what, it'll take a year, a lifetime of change for you, and you've got to figure out a new way to do it. There's so many things to learn about the brain, and especially for those that have gone and served in this war, because if you look at Vietnam, where 12 million Americans served in the war, now only 1.5 million have served in this war. Probably most of the people in this room don't even know them, or know many of them. I know tons of them now, but I didn't know many before. And that's 1/8 as many that served in Vietnam. So and now they're going back multiple times, maybe fourth or fifth time already. We owe something for them to figure out what's going on in those brains, because people need it, even if it's some kind of PDS problem, PTSD, or some kind of a TBI. I think a lot needs to be owed, and really great to talk to you about it. I don't want to speak a little bit too much, but I just want to thank you all. And there's a lot of work to be done on this, both scientifically and politically. But let me just say that first, though, because with this issue, certainly with the ones that are in the war, this is such a non-political question. So this is one of those ones that we've done where it's absolutely not that at all. This is about doing something for the people in our country that have done this for us. And more needs to be done. So teach me about brains, okay. And it's your turn.
I'm going to ask Bob a few questions that will help us understand consciousness better based on his experience, and we'll turn it over to the audience to ask questions. So my first question for you is, what is your interior subjective experience from the moment you first woke up to now? And what do you think that tells us about the brain and consciousness?
Well, one thing is for sure, that during the coma, I don't have any memories at all. There's only two things I remember. One of them, what I explained to you, which is about seeing after this explosion, when I did wake up and I became conscious again, was seeing everybody sitting in the tank. And after that, I don't remember. I also remember after when I was hit, I remember my body floating below me. I don't know exactly what it was, but I know that my body was floating underneath me. And that was the only two things that I remember at all from that. Now, when I was awoken after March 5th, I do remember my brothers coming in. I remember my wife being there, and I still remember to this day for some reason, maybe because I wrote about it pretty quickly after I was able to write again. I said, honey, thank you for coming, or whatever I said. But I also tried to watch, even if I tried to watch television, very simple shows, I could not really understand exactly what was going on.
What did the word sound like, a foreign language?
You know, in some ways, I think what would happen is if I heard a word that I did not understand it right then, I stopped listening to the other words after that and tried to concentrate on that one to try to say it over and over and over again. What does this word mean? What does this word mean? And I know it's a word that, of course, knew perfectly before, and now I just don't understand what it is. So even like when you speak something to some degree, I sometimes have to stop for a little bit and I don't listen to the rest of the sentence.
Well, you're not alone in that. That's most of my audience.
Well, you know what I do say is, one of the jokes that I say is that I really only like to hang out with people at least 45 like me, because that's when the brain also starts to deteriorate a little bit too. So thank you for that.
So if you compare before and after the injury, we all are conscious of being conscious. It's one of the things that makes us human. That we're aware of ourselves, and it's like an infinite regress, right? We're aware of being aware of being aware. So if I asked you, if you looked at your own internal awareness, your subjective state of being, is there anything that you can say starkly separates before and after?
Well, I mean, the only thing I know that in terms of the change, I can't. Obviously, what I tell you about, I don't have any other synonyms, for example, I can remember. I know that there's multiple ways to say something, and I can't say it still. I am, in terms of emotion, I think I'm less afraid of negative things happening than I was before, which is kind of in some ways the opposite of PTSD. I also feel less afraid to die. Maybe that's partly because I've kind of felt what it was like to be out cold. And maybe those who have gone through this had that feeling. And my wife says that I used to be, you know, at certain moments, I was a real jerk. And I'm no longer at all anymore.
And so my last question is, whatever it meant for you to feel like what Bobness was, Bobness, that we all have a sense of ourselves and what we are. Did that change in any way? Do you feel like a different person?
Well, I mean, there are also moments, I have to say, that probably once a month there is a kind of depression that kind of kicks in. But my wife does claim that I had that before. Like if I was back from a story that I'd been away for 2 weeks and it had been this amazing story that we're doing for journalism, and suddenly there was nothing really breaking out, and I was kind of sitting around home like this, you know. I love my kids and I love my family. I really wanted to go to work, so I'm kind of like a little depressed then, so maybe that's just what's happening again. But the Bob change, I don't know. It's a good question. I think that's something we'll see more and more as we go forward. But I think the other thing, too, and when you think about what's happening to a lot of the ones in the war that have come back with a similar problem with TBI, is a lot of these guys are 19, 20, 21 years old, and they have either they've just gotten out of high school, or maybe they somewhere have more training and they've been in college or something, and this has happened to them, and then they have to think about their life now. What am I going to do now? I have this inability on many things now. They don't have in their past, like you and I have had, about having accomplished what we've done and had certain things that are our life that was good, and that makes it a little bit more comfortable. So I kind of feel I'm filled with guilt, no question about it, about some of the aspects of what's happened with me. I feel guilt about what I put my family through, my kids and my wife and my family, my brothers, my neighbors. And I also feel guilt about what's happened to others because so many that I've come back from the war that I've met, I know so many of them now and I've visited so many, some that have done better than me, but so many of them have done worse. And if they had, and some of those don't have a really close wife, a really close family, a company that continues to pay your salary. They have to then be out on their own to figure out what they're going to do next. And to me, I feel, you know, if there's anything that we can do to change that, I mean, certainly that is part of me that's changed now. It's my kind of charity life is now, one of the things that I spent so much time is not only writing, going out and signing the book, which took a lot of time, but going back to journalism now, which is just something I'm spending tons of time on now, and I can't wait getting on the road. But also doing this foundation that we started to try to help to raise some money and some more attention to those that are going this kind of thing, not only just because of the war, but because of the inability to know so much about the brain, traumatic brain injury especially. So that's taken up a lot of time.
Well, great. Thank you. I'd like to now take a few questions. We have two microphones. So if anyone would like to ask Bob a question, step up to the microphone and please say your name before asking the question. Yes.
I'm Judy Allen from Houston. My sister is here from Asunción, Paraguay. We have a younger brother, age we will not discuss, who has developed either frontal lobe dementia or Alzheimer's, the show sign of both, but it's overlaid with something called cognitive aphasia. He will know that this thing in his hand is what turns on the car, but he doesn't know it's called a key. So he's lost word ability. When you were struggling to regain your speech and your knowledge of words, did you understand process but not how to call it? Such as, did you know that when someone gave you the silverware and said, set the table, you knew that was a table, whereas my brother doesn't know that, but if I say, will you put these on the place where we eat? It's easy.
Well, sounds like he forgets specific numbers. There's no question I have aphasia as well. And they've said they've identified that from the very beginning that there's aphasia. I assume that they're correct. I guess the one thing that I could say is the kind of improvement over aphasia is possible. I mean, you saw just a little bit of what I could say in the beginning. I mean, I can see this thing for as a hammer, but I can't remember how to say hammer. And even if I thought of the word hammer, I guess that word is not really appearing in my brain clearly.
But you knew what to do with it.
Yes, that's. I think that is true. I think when if something pretty simple like that, like a hammer or a plate or something, I would know exactly what to do with that. But you said he grabs those and doesn't know what to do with the hammer.
Oh, no, he knows
what
to do with it.
Oh, he does. Okay, so he has the same aphasia issue.
Yes, I didn't know if that had improved. Well, obviously it's improved for you through the flashcards and lots of work. So that gives me hope.
Thank you very much.
And that's true, too, that part of the kind of practice, the rehabilitation, you go see an OT to try to help with that. That is one thing. But also, again, it's like what also shocked me is how slow the recovery of things coming back, that some of them are coming back automatically without practicing them and restudying.
Another question over here.
My name is Marianne Peoples. You said when you woke up, you recognized your wife. You didn't remember your children's names, but did you realize, even though you couldn't verbalize it, what had happened to you? And did you know that those were your children, even though you didn't know their names? Or did you just forget?
Well, I still don't remember. I said that I don't remember exactly my younger two, but I think because they weren't there. But as soon as they all showed up, I knew them. I knew all of them, all that stuff. In fact, even to this day, seeing things happening, and even with journalistic stories, I understand what's going on and I can think about them. I just can't the way to really say it sometimes.
But you realized you'd been in Iraq and you'd been a reporter.
It took me a while. In fact, in one of those pieces that we've got, we didn't have it there. I mean, sitting in the chair, and my brother's asking me, so when you were in Iraq? And I said, Elad. And they said, no, when you were in Iraq. I said, I couldn't really say exactly what it was. And a lot of these names, I couldn't say at all. But I did not really, in the beginning for sure, I didn't really know much about what was happening in Iraq. I know there was some kind of fighting going on, but I don't think I could really remember quite exactly how the war began. And I've still forgotten certainly some of the things that I'd read about and knew and had memorized before that has not come back. And I think it may or may not, or now it's time to just restudy new things and start at a different place.
One more question.
I've had the great good fortune to work with Bob Woodruff, and I can tell you that what hasn't changed is his unbelievable sense of humor, his incredible warmth, and just his expansive and generous personality. So it's a particular thrill to see you up there. My question is, are you still doing rehab? And if you could tell us what kind of rehab you're doing, if you are. And then the second part of the question would be for Eric, wondering if those kinds of mental exercises or whatever it is that you're doing could be used by other people who are having other kinds of memory loss issues or similar problems.
Well, just about my rehabilitation, my cognitive rehabilitation that I was starting out, I was going about 6 days a week when I, you know, about a month after I came out of Bethesda. Thank you. See, there it goes. Right there. It flows out for a second. And then I went up to Sinai up in New York, and I went there about 5 days a week, and then another one on the weekend. I had another one come in and give me that kind of memorization of words and so on. My kind of cognitive that I'm doing now is really going to things like this and doing investigations, doing journalistic work, conversations with people. Speaking, that's my kind of rehabilitation now. And I think in some ways it's better. If I spent a lot of these guys, for example, in the military, they get maybe half an hour, an hour to the day to do that kind of rehabilitation. And I've got the ability with many different ways to do it, and I think it's all helpful. But there's also very good doctors that are helping with this to help you memorize things. And I think that would be helpful if I get back. If I get a few more hours, then I can probably go back and do that in the hospitals.
Thank you, Bob. To answer your question, yes, the brain is a muscle, really. And like a muscle, the more you use it, the better it gets, and you have to use it or lose it. And that is as true for people who have had brain injury or Alzheimer's or other brain deficits or, quote, normal people. I mean, for example, taxi cab drivers in London have a part of their brain that processes spatial memory called the hippocampus, and it's huge because they have to remember spatial. And so for all of us, the more exercise you do with your brain, and what that really means is just like exercising your muscles, it has to hurt you a little bit. No pain, no gain. And with that, I would like to extend my profound thanks to Bob. you know, your brain and its recovery are amazing, but more remarkable to me is your heart. So thank you very much.